I think the difference between a pretty watered down treaty and a really rigorous one is how successful we are as a global community at delivering on what we actually committed to in 22, which was to end plastic pollution.
Welcome to Global Dispatches, a podcast for the foreign policy and global development communities and anyone who wants a deeper understanding of what is driving events in the world today. I'm your host, Mark Leon Goldberg. I am a veteran international affairs journalist and the editor of UN Dispatch. Enjoy the show. Looking for a trustworthy podcast to bring you unfiltered viewpoints and experiences on global health? Tune into Global Health Matters, the podcast that connects silos and amplifies diverse voices to give you a holistic picture. Each month, Dr. Gary Aslanian from the World Health Organization hosts discussions with guests spanning former ministers of health, award-winning journalists and authors, and frontline public health workers. Join listeners from across 180 countries for an exciting season 4, launching in June. Global Health Matters is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Diplomats are gathering in Ottawa this week for the latest round of negotiations on a treaty to end plastic pollution. Back in 2022, 175 countries agreed to develop a legally binding agreement on plastic pollution by 2024. This meeting in Ottawa is the penultimate round of negotiations and a critical moment in the long effort to curb the environmental damage caused by the rampant production and use of plastic today. On the line with me to discuss what these negotiators hope to achieve and some of the key obstacles in the way of a robust treaty on plastic pollution is Aaron Simon, Vice President and Head of Plastic Waste and Business at the World Wildlife Fund. We kick off discussing the problem of plastic pollution before having a broader conversation about these treaty negotiations. We first covered this topic when negotiations on this treaty first kicked off in Uruguay. And now, as we are racing towards that 2024 finish line for a plastic pollution treaty, I'm glad to bring you this update from the negotiations and preview what to expect as negotiators race to the finish line. So here is Aaron Simon of the World Wildlife Fund. Aaron, before we talk about the substance of a potential treaty on plastics, can you just make the case for why there ought to be such a treaty in the first place?
So the world comes together and requires a treaty when there is an issue that can't be solved by individual nations on their own, right? When the problem is so large that it requires a coordinated global action. In fact, there has never been a global crisis that has been effectively addressed without one. So as we look at plastic pollution and we look at how quickly it is accumulating, one dump truck a minute of plastic pollution is entering our oceans every day, rising to about 10 million metric tons a year. And we're on a track to triple that and quadruple how much is actually there in less than 20 years if we don't change anything. Plastic pollution is such a global issue. It has this huge scale at which it's entering the world at such a fast pace, but it also represents both production, use, and waste supply chains that don't adhere to country boundaries. So you can't solve for it in one part of the world and assume that we'll solve for it in another. And because of that, you've seen the efforts that have gone into it to solve it without this global coordination, whether it's companies doubling down on their commitments or individual governments putting out policies and bans, that in the process of all of that growth of effort, plastic pollution is continuing to grow. it's clearly needed that we need to have the world come together and agree on how to address it collectively instead of separately.
Is the problem of plastic pollution fundamentally one related to marine life, or is it something broader than that?
It's much broader than that. And actually, the resolution that negotiators have agreed to negotiate is about the whole life cycle of plastic. It really highlights that plastic pollution happens from the moment plastic is produced, right? 99% of plastics today are coming from oil and gas. And so it identifies that you have plastic pollution entering our communities and our ecosystems from production through use and into its persistence as waste, where it's harming, again, communities and ecosystems and species.
So what does a potential treaty on plastics seek to do? I know we are speaking just a few weeks before negotiators head to Ottawa, Canada, for yet another round intended to produce a treaty on plastics. What are some key elements of this draft treaty?
Part of the benefit of the UN process and the law of treaties is that all of the countries that are participating agree to a framework on how to address the problem, a common set of rules, if you will, for what each country should be committing to do. And so we would hope that these common set of rules that the countries agree to, which should make up the text of the treaty, would account for the key levers that the broader scientific community has said we need to do to end this crisis. One of those is we should all agree, what are those high-risk chemicals and products and criteria on how to determine them and a plan on how to phase them out. Those could be chemicals or products that are high risk for leakage somewhere in the life cycle and high risk for creating damage when they are leaked, whether to people or species.
Like the idea is that plants that make plastic products use these chemicals and that sometimes these chemicals get into the ecosystem in some way and cause harm?
That's correct. Yes. Through emissions, through runoff, sort of those implications to air, soil, and water, those main things that humans depend on for feed and water and oxygen. So basic human rights, if you will. So you first say, as agree as a global community, what shouldn't we be making in the first place? And for everything else that you should continue making, you agree on how everyone is going to make it. What are those design standards? And why that's so important is, one, it creates alignment around reducing those harmful chemicals. But two, it means that you can match infrastructure to manage those materials with the materials that you have. One of the barriers to recycling today, for example, is because we have proliferated the types of plastics and materials we use without advancing the recycling technology to be able to manage that large array and variety of materials that end up in our material recycling facilities. So if you're going to design materials for the infrastructure that you are going to invest in globally, you want to make sure that everybody's doing it the same. That's going to be especially important for countries who are not producing countries who just receive materials, but are being asked to invest in infrastructure to manage those. And so we want to have those design guidelines, because that is going to really make it easier to create a system to recover those, whether that's a reuse system, a recycling system, a compost system. You'll be building and investing in that technology to manage those materials. It'll increase the consistency that goes into that infrastructure. It'll increase the quality of materials coming out the other side, which will increase the value of it. It's about jobs. It's about dollars. All of those things are just sort of guided by this common set of design guidelines, right? And then finally, you need a treaty that has policies that can create those enabling mechanisms through an extended producer responsibility system, for example, that could drive the mandate for those guidelines and for a fee associated with them, and create a longer term operating budget for those facilities, especially in small and medium economies. It should have a financial mechanism that supports this growth and innovation so that we can implement and do capacity building globally for this. And it should ultimately have a common way that we all measure, you know, the plastic pollution that we're creating in the world and what we're doing to solve it, so we can check and make sure we're making progress together as a global community, course correct when we need to, strengthen as we learn more. So that's what we're really hoping that the global set of sort of rules that everybody would agree to would include.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, it sounds, as you're describing it, like a very kind of technical treaty that compels signatories and those countries that ratify it to adhere to a certain set of standards. But like, I have to imagine, having covered treaty processes in general, not this one in particular, but in general for the last like 20 years, that there are key political debates that go along with creating some of these standards that often have the potential to upend, if not derail, sensitive negotiations like this. I'm keen to learn from you what some of those like higher level political debates and discussions are looking like.
There is a great deal of tension in this process. There's a tension between global rules versus national action plans to begin with.
Oh, the idea that like some countries just want to have their own kind of voluntary plans with no real enforcement mechanism.
Exactly.
That's all in vogue now in these environmental treaties, I feel like.
Yeah, and it's really for an issue like this, where these materials, both as in a feedstock and in a product, are flowing across all of these country boundaries, it's very difficult to consider how that would actually help us to solve this problem, because that is what we have happening right now, and it has proven to be unsuccessful in stemming the tide in plastic pollution. That's one of the arguments that you hear often from sort of the countries who are in support of this top-down or global rule-based mechanism, is that it needs to address the issues we can't address on our own. Now, adding a layer of tension to that are countries that agree with that, but also legally, from a domestic or national policy perspective, have limitations to what they can even ratify. And so they are trying to negotiate the line of that, where there is a universal provision, but yet more autonomy in the regional implementation.
Would that include, say, like the United States?
That is a great example of a country that is challenged by existing authorities.
Yeah, I mean, just politically, it's very difficult to get 70 senators to agree on anything, which
yes,
is like 2/3 is the threshold required to ratify a treaty. So the idea here is that the United States still wants like an enforcement mechanism without requiring ratification. Am I getting that right?
I think they still want to have these universal provisions, but without the requirement for new policy to be developed.
Mm.
So therefore not requiring that congressional ratification process.
In general, like what are some of the key like negotiating blocks in a treaty like this? In general, you will often have certain groups of countries band together to pursue common interests, and sometimes those conflict with the interests of other groups of countries. What are some of those fault lines you're seeing?
The first fault line that started to come about was this essentially labeling of countries as ambitious or not ambitious. And that really progressed pretty quickly coming out of the first INC, or Intergovernmental Non-Negotiating Committee meeting.
What do you mean by ambitious? In this context,
these countries were saying we need to start with cutting the amount of plastics we use in the first place. This theory comes from the fact that if we can't manage the plastic we're using now, and we're slated to double that in less than 20 years, we're never going to be able to catch up with just waste management alone. You have to reduce the size of that circle. And it's hard to disagree with that. You had all of these stakeholders sort of saying, you had the scientific community, you had the business community, actually all agreeing with this very, very high level ambition and saying, we need to start by making less and agreeing what we're going to make moving forward and invest in the infrastructure and add policy. And that fast wave of very progressive positioning kept its momentum into INC2. And a couple of things sort of stalled it out.
And just to be clear, INC2 is International Negotiation Committee, and this happens in phases, and the second one, which I think was Uruguay?
Yeah, it was in Uruguay. You know, every treaty negotiation process, it has to have at least 5 INCs, right? And they usually take a decent amount of time to negotiate, usually around 10 years. And part of the resolution 5.2 that was unanimously adopted by the UN member states back in 22 was that they would do this in 2 years, that they would accelerate the timeline. And I think everybody was really excited about it. But what you're finding is that it is happening too fast for people to catch up with that momentum. And in a process like the UN process that is designed to bring everyone together and find common ground, that tension of those who already understood the science, were riding that wave of momentum for high ambition, and those who are like, whoa, 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 wait a minute, that is way more than we're willing to negotiate for. That became very clear in Uruguay when we started to see stall tactics, especially from producing countries, because at the top of this is less production. You know, that top statement is we need to start with making less. And that hits a bottom line, right? That's an economic impact and hit to countries that depend heavily on the production of oil and gas.
Are the same countries that produce plastics, generally speaking, the oil and gas countries?
Yes, generally speaking. Mm-hmm. Oil and gas, you know, 99% of this is coming from oil and gas. It comes out of that barrel of oil, just like our fuel and our energy mm-hmm. does. Just a different carbon chain, if that makes sense. It's just a different length of carbon.
So I would imagine that like the negotiating blocks, as you described them, are not terribly dissimilar to what we've seen at the COP in the past, the UN climate conferences.
It's absolutely going to be that same community. And I would argue that chemicals that are produced out of a barrel of oil and that are used to produce plastics are pretty high value, and they've been highly subsidized. They've got a high value to them. And so I do believe that there are a number of those countries that are producing countries, and not all of them, but a number of them who are really concerned about what this could mean. And so we started to see that tension early on because their strong positioning that they want to continue to produce, but also because they felt like this was moving really fast without them. And so as a person who arguably sits within the observer pool for this process and is a material scientist as my background, and you know, I work for a conservation organization, and my mission is to help address this problem pragmatically and thoughtfully, I was really frustrated right away when I saw the stall tactics happening because I felt like they represented sort of industry just fighting. But I see another layer of that now that I've observed the process a bit more. And it is not just that I want to keep producing. It's also feeling like we were progressing for change too quickly and they weren't ready for that. And I'm not saying that in the last year since INC2, as we head into INC4, just 12 months later, right? That is how fast these are, every 6 months, that has changed that much. But you start to understand how you have to meet each of these member states for a really constructive discussion about how to move forward on common ground. And you start to figure out how do you build those right solutions into the instrument so that we can do something effective with it and not create an empty, watered down treaty that actually nothing changes with. And so it's been hard to observe that and see that happen both in Uruguay and in Nairobi. But going into INC4, it's going to be really important that we do come together and move away from that divisive tension of the ambitious and the not ambitious as we move forward. And I know that sounds very Pollyanna of me, but that's really going to be important, is that we sort of have that we are the world moment in Canada and find some common ground. I think that of the tensions and debates that have been happening, I think that underlying theme has been the biggest. There are discussions around whether or not we should have lists of products, whether or not there should even be criteria, whether it should be upstream and or just downstream, meaning like production versus waste management. There's been a lot of those discussions, but primarily, they all are fundamentally on how the treaty is shaped, what kind of binding provisions it does include. The other debates are obviously around how do we financially support SMEs?
That's small and medium enterprises.
Yes, or small and medium economies that need to be really successful along with the global north, right? Like there's inequities built into the global process that come with those who are much larger economies, come with larger delegations, more lawyers, more scientists, more expertise. And plastics pollution is one of those issues that if we are not successful everywhere, we won't be successful at all.
So delegates are meeting in Ottawa for this fourth round. What comes after? Because we know that, as you said earlier, the intention here is to get a treaty done by 2024.
Yeah, this year.
Yes, which last I checked is this year. Yes.
Yes, this year. It's kind of overwhelming. No, so in INC 4, they need to take the updated draft text and negotiate it throughout the week plus that we will have in Ottawa so that coming out of INC 4, we have an updated and very close to final text. Very close, so that in INC 5, which will happen at the end of this year in November in South Korea, we can finalize the treaty text. And so in the diplomatic conference that should happen in early to mid of 2025, it will be ready for ratification.
So this is just like a very important moment in that process, obviously.
It is a pivotal moment. How well the text gets negotiated and how good the member states are at finding paths forward together, finding common ground, creating the structure of a text that ultimately allows us to start as ambitiously as possible, but also continue to strengthen through the COP process. So that's the conferences of the parties that will happen following ratification. That is going to be dependent on how good they are in Ottawa at coming together. If they continue to sit back in their corners and not find common ground, then we will be kicking the can down the road. We will be pushing that to INC 5 and hoping for something different, which could allow us to bleed over into 2025.
I suppose maybe just big picture, how does the world look different between having no treaty, having relatively weak treaty language, or having a strong treaty language on controlling in one way or another plastics?
You know, I think no matter what, the treaty process itself has already changed the way we think about materials and plastics. It's already triggered policy and redesign and new business models. So a new business model, for example, would be delivering a beverage in a reusable container or a returnable cup versus doing it in a plastic bottle, a single-use plastic bottle. So that's already happening. But I think the difference between a pretty watered-down treaty and a really rigorous one is how successful we are as a global community at delivering on what we actually committed to in 22, which was to end plastic pollution. Ending plastic pollution, stopping plastics from going into our ecosystems and into our communities requires us to reduce how much we make. There is no modeling done by any viable scientific institution that exists today that shows us being successful at all without reduction at the start. And so that's going to be one of the hardest points, right? So how successful we are at stopping pollution will depend on how willing we are to understand and make that sacrifice and make that commitment to change at a larger scale and at a coordinated scale. And that's the second piece. How much coordination is designed into the mechanism will be the second factor in determining how successful we are. If, for example, companies have to continue to design for 190 different infrastructure systems and 190 different policy landscapes, it will increase their risk and their costs, and therefore they will invest less because it won't be as safe and they will pass more costs on to the consumer. If it is consistent globally, it reduces that risk, allowing them to invest more into that standardized technology, that standardized guidelines, and reduce the cost and the risks overall. The ultimate outcomes, if we do this in a coordinated way, are going to be much more beneficial to people than if we don't. So I think it's that range of where we're going to be. I'm guessing we're going to land somewhere in the middle. If we're successful in Ottawa at getting to an updated text, I think we're going to have a chance at hitting somewhere in a good middle range with a start and strengthen where we can kind of build out more of those key provisions around criteria, some of those more technical elements that I outlined earlier. I think we could do that. I think there might be appetite for that.
Erin, thank you so much for your time.
No problem.
Thanks for listening to Global Dispatches. The show is produced by me, Mark Leon Goldberg. It is edited and mixed by Levi Sharp. If you are listening on Apple Podcasts, make sure to follow the show and enable automatic downloads to get new episodes as soon as they're released. On Spotify, tap the bell icon to get a notification when we publish new episodes. And of course, please visit globaldispatches.org to get on our free mailing list, get in touch with me, and access our full archive. Thank you.